Hello and welcome to the Show Up podcast, a place where we explore this thing called leadership, how we make sense of it, and a space where you can do the same, a chance to reflect on how you show up and how you can be the best leader possible in the world in which you work today. Hello, folks, and welcome back to season three of the Show Up podcast. It's the start of 2024.
Season three.
Who'd have thunk it? It's the start of a new year. It's freezing cold in the UK. Probably going to get a little bit colder before the end of the week. How are you, chaps? How was Christmas and New Year?
It was very nice, actually. It's already a distant memory, having been back properly at work for 2.5 days, but it was very nice.
Excellent. Yeah, I had a great one. My wife came home for a couple of weeks, which was lovely to be all together. Went and saw the big man up in Lapland. And just a very magical Christmas in so many ways.
Did the big man give you what you wanted for Christmas?
Yeah, because I didn't ask for much.
You made it easy for him.
Yeah, I made it easy for him. You know, he's got a lot on his plate, you know, a few billion homes to get to. So I decided to keep it simple. But yeah, and I had a great time. I aged over the holiday as well. So that seems to be an annual occurrence. So,
happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday to you.
So yeah.
You don't look a day older.
I don't look a day older because once you lose your hair, age doesn't really show.
Unless you have a beard, and then it does. I'm learning.
I wasn't going to comment on the slightly more Welshness of the grey that you seem to have adopted.
Yeah, a bit more slate.
A bit more slate.
Whenever I talk about shaving my beard off, my kids have an absolute meltdown there. They are not up for it at all.
Oh, really? So they've
become
attached.
We could make the whole podcast about what bald men should do on their face. Should they have a beard? Should they have some sort of glasses? What should they do? That could be a whole episode that we may never record.
So relevant to the golden age of leaders, and many of whom, or will be in the future anyway.
Well, we've got public appearance. You know, there's a theme for it, and the impact of public appearance.
It's true. Personal brand. It's very important for 2024.
Oh, I read something
the
other day
for season four, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, chalk that one up for season four. I actually read something about color matching the other day. The re-emergence of the Gen Z interest in, do you remember in the sort of late 80s and early 90s, there was the kind of colour me beautiful concept. Well, I was reading it over the Christmas period, a variety of things. And one of them was about the re-emergence of that as a thing that people are interested in, understanding how to use colour to kind of create an impact, but understand what shows up well with them and so on and so forth. Quite interesting to see that sort of come back full cycle 30, 40 years later.
But anyone just
because the world is getting increasingly grey. I've seen analysis of how color is moving out of the world, or black, white, and grey. If you look at cars, for example, so many of them now have no color, black, white, and grey, and that has been a bit of a consistent theme. So it's really good to hear color is making a comeback.
It is. It is, certainly is.
For those listening to the podcast for the first time, here's an insight into where this podcast kind of goes, because the thought that's just gone in my head is that my dad actually went through a whole color matching thing in the 80s and 90s at his work, and it resulted in him not ever wearing a plain white shirt for work ever.
Wow.
He always wore off-white because of that whole color matching experience that he went through. Thing is, you put him in a plain white shirt today, he was in a suit at a wedding and a plain white shirt the other day, and it's exactly the best color for him in terms of that kind of thing. And we told him for years, but he would not shift because of it.
Deeply ingrained. Talking of reading, chaps, I am aware that there was a book that you guys both read over Christmas.
That's the first time that's ever happened, Derry. And yeah, that's just me reading a book. So, let's celebrate that.
I mean, it's remarkable that of the 17 or so books on my bedside table, this one got read and you'd also read it. But there we are.
And it seemed to be kind of appropriate. I mean, you picked this up this morning and said, should we talk about this book? And I said, well, I haven't read it. But actually, given what we just talked about before we started recording about what the book's topic and subject matter is related to, looking forward into 2024, one of the other things that we tend to do at the start of a season is to say, what might the year ahead bring and what we're sort of anticipating? And every single thing I read right now suggests that the continuation of turbulence, uncertainty, complexity, you know, all those sort of factors in both the economy, geopolitically, are there to stay for us, with us for at least this year, if not beyond that. And the year started with all sorts of media stories about elections, the Middle East, and therefore, goodness me, if I'm going to be stepping into a leadership role this year, learning how to think differently, maybe about myself, the kind of mindset I need to bring to that, and maybe the mindsets of the people around me, seems to be a very appropriate topic to start the year on. And I think that's kind of a nice segue into what's this book about then?
Shall I give a little overview? The book we're talking about is The Pattern Seekers by Simon Baron Cohen, A New Theory of Human Invention. And as the title suggests, it's a book about invention, but it's really a book about brain types and the types of brains that enable invention. I find it just super fascinating. So Simon Baron Cohen is probably the leading global researcher in autism and has studied brains of various kinds for 35 years.
And this is not to be mistaken with Sacha Baron Cohen, who is, I think, related to him, and he's known very well for other things, which is not related to serious study of human beings.
Are they related? I didn't know.
I believe they're cousins.
Yes.
But yeah, they are related. The Baron Cohen family is impressively talented in various different ways. Yeah. So the key tenet of this book, and one of the reasons I found it very interesting, was that 70 to 100,000 years ago, there were evolutionary steps that humans went through that have set us apart from other species and created two ways of thinking or ways of solving problems or engaging with the world. And one of those he calls the systematizing mechanism, and the other he calls the empathy circuit. So systematizing is really about pattern spotting. So that's why he's called the book The Pattern Seekers, because if you're an extreme systematizer, you are very, very good and in fact drawn to spotting patterns and repeating those patterns to check that they keep working and then adjusting those patterns to see something if something different happens. And he talks about an if and then process. So if this situation and this thing come together, then this happens.
The classic hypothesis statement. Mm.
Very much a hypothesis statement, yeah, and very scientific. And he quotes various inventors like Thomas Edison and Bill Gates and Elon Musk as very clearly demonstrating these thought processes when it comes to invention. And his argument is that every invention is a use of this if and then pattern, where you spot something that works repeatedly and then you adjust it, you experiment, or you model it out in some way and see what changes, and that leads to invention. So that's the systematizing side. And then on the other side, he has the empathy circuit, which is really about understanding other people, the feelings of other people, and being able to respond to those feelings. And he splits empathy into cognitive empathy, and I can't remember what he calls the other one for now, but the empathy of understanding how someone's feeling versus the empathy of trying to respond to how they're feeling. And it's a bit of a zero-sum game for most people. You're either high systematizing, low empathy, balanced of the two, or high empathy, low systematizer. And the thing that I found interesting, particularly in the context of those who are leading teams in this turbulent time, is your team will consist of people who are a mix of these different brain types. And he articulates five different brain types, but essentially it's type S, systematizing, type E, empathizing, and type B, which is balanced. And the other two are just extreme S and extreme E. And we could talk a bit about the makeup of those different groups and how it varies by gender, etc. But the thing that's interesting, I think, is in your team, whichever team you're leading, whichever group of people you're leading, you will have some people who lean towards systematizing and some people who lean towards empathy. And both of those skill sets are going to be really important in a turbulent time where there are lots of novel problems to solve and there's lots of emotion running high and people to support and influence and lead, it's going to be really important to understand and tap into those different traits, essentially.
How widely socialized are these, some of these thoughts, or is this pretty much new thinking that's being published?
The earliest publications, I think, were about 20 years ago. And there's pretty widely used. So he has two different assessments, a systematizing quotient and an empathy quotient. They've used that on a thing called the UK Brain Study, which had 600,000 participants. So they've done large scale research on these things. I'm not aware. I hadn't heard of it before, and I'm reasonably tuned into personality profiling literature. On the tune of, you know, MBTI and colors and big five personality traits, etc. So I don't know how the extent to which it's got beyond the academic literature into day-to-day business use. I like it because it's a really simplified version of all of the different personality models that are out there.
Mm. Yeah, I think as a leader, I found it a very, what's the word to describe it? I like simplified. If you need just a litmus test for where someone might be leaning on a preference, this kind of way of looking at it could be really, really powerful, because we know leaders are quite full, but it's easy to get your head around the concept that people have a brain that systemizes things, but there's also a feeling side in, as it shows up in this empathy circuit. To fill in the blank, Derry, cognitive empathy, which is defined as the ability to imagine the thoughts and feelings of another person, and affective empathy, defined as the drive to respond to another's thoughts and feelings with an appropriate emotion. So it feels like, you know, engaging with what could be going on and doing something with it. Those two types of pattern in that empathy circuit.
And from a neurodiversity perspective, the really interesting thing there is autistic people generally find cognitive empathy more challenging to identify and truly understand how someone else is feeling. But the I've forgotten the word again.
Affective.
Sorry, yeah, because it's not really a word. Anyway, affective empathy is something that a lot of autistic people really naturally go to. And so I think when there's a bit of controversy around some of these concepts, because there's an implication, and sorry, I didn't say this, but the extreme type S brain is more highly associated with autistic people. So there's a systematizing quotient and empathy quotient that you can do. And in the book, there's very simple versions of those. They're 10 questions each. And you just state how strongly you agree or disagree with those 10 questions, and it leads to a score. They are simplified versions of slightly longer surveys that are 22 or 24 questions, I think, for the 22 for the systematizing and 24 for empathy. There's also an autistic quotient test in there, and there is a reasonably strong correlation between people that are extreme type S systematizers and people who score highly on the autistic quotient. And so the controversy around these ideas are there's an implication there that autistic people can't empathize, which doesn't fit with the experiences of many autistic people who are strong at certain types of empathy. So I find it fascinating.
Yeah, so go on, Graham.
No, I was going to say, you know, I picked up the book. I was literally I was going to go and sit in a coffee shop in Hong Kong for a few hours. And there was a bookstore nearby. I had a few hours and I didn't want to spend the time on my phone. So I looked through what was available, and this jumped out to me as something to be quite curious about. Because, you know, from my own experience of people and supporting people in a learning environment, how they get to learning moments and what gets in the way and what ignites them, this just spoke to me. Because, you know, I'm sure you can quote the number to me. I'm sure one of our previous guests has talked to the number of the increasing rate of autistic diagnosis in the adult world.
I can't quote the number, but it is increasing.
But yeah. It's either spoken about more, even just on that kind of metric. So I'm curious myself to learn more about, well, what views are there out there? Rather than to judge it being a problem, because it's not. It's just what we've got. So how can we make the best of what we've got? So that's where my interest in the book sort of came from.
Is there anything in the book that talks about the relative size of the populations? You know, they did 600,000 people in that brain study in the UK. They give a relative split?
And so in type B, the balanced version is about 30% of people, which in itself is interesting, right? So that means 70% of people are leaning one way or the other. And when you get to extreme type E, so the hyper empathizers, that's only 4% of people. Extreme type S is 6% of people. So slight shift towards extreme type S. But one of the interesting things is in extreme type S, there are twice as many men as women. And in extreme type E, there are three times as many women as men. So when you get to those extremes of the distribution curve, which I think is something we've talked about before, because at the average level, in terms of gender differences, there's not a lot of difference. And as you get to the extremes of a distribution curve of different personality traits, you see much, much bigger differences. And that plays out in the data that they see here. There's a little bit of a technical watch out on those numbers, because part of the way that they've defined extreme type S and extreme type E is a statistical measure of it being in the top 2.5% of highest differences between S and E. So Jamie, to your question, it's roughly, very roughly a third in type E and extreme E, type S and extreme S, and balanced. There's a pretty decent distribution curve.
That's very interesting. But then there's differences around gender at the extremes. Is there anything that does it change?
And in type E and type S as well. So the female distribution curve is very much skewed towards E, and the male is very much skewed towards S.
And then generally over time, does it change with age? Did they not talk about that?
I believe he said there's no difference by age. I don't remember.
I don't remember that bit, to be honest.
So this is something that kind of there's no temporal transition. So you don't start with being more systematizing and then shift towards, depending on exposure to people in a workplace or socially, becoming more empathetic. It's very much this is an underlying trait, underlying way of thinking.
That is my understanding from the book, but I wouldn't want to quote.
Like, I'd be interested to, if I was to take this forward and do some research myself, I would be interested to explore how an extreme type S develops their empathy skills through life, because they tend to learn it through that if and then experiments. And conversely, how an extreme type E would learn to systemize.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, right? So can you do if and then pattern recognition to learn to mimic empathy even if you don't really feel it? Really, like when you talk about autistic masking, in many cases, that is exactly what people are doing.
It's like a human version of machine learning. It's running as many scenarios as possible to say, if I try this when you're smiling, what then happens? And if you're doing it when you're looking puzzled, I've got to try out a number of different things, because looking puzzled could be early stages of anger, could be curiosity, could be fear, could be anxiety, you know, whatever it might be. So I've got to try a few things out in order for me to work out what's most appropriate in that situation.
And if you're an autistic person who's on that extreme type S, in that extreme type S bucket, which is where I came out when I did the quotient, my wife came out extreme type E, which is an interesting.
You balance each other. It's the yin and the yang of the Hughes household.
Yeah. Remarkable that we've ever got married, you could argue. But so if you're in that extreme type S and you're trying to recognize those patterns, can be extremely stressful, because you know the if and then, but you can't predict it because it's not reliable, because you're not sure what someone else is thinking. And so you try these things out, but you've got to fail multiple times to learn what the pattern is. You know, you get an if of Jamie's looking puzzled and I respond like this. Oh, that wasn't the outcome I wanted. Right, I'll try again. But by that point, you've often endured quite a lot of stress, or you've broken relationships, etc. And I think that is one of the root causes for a lot of autistic people finding human interactions very draining.
Yeah, and I think of parents who are parents to children who have yet to be diagnosed as autistic. And I wonder what goes through the mind of the child when they're learning the patterns of the world, which we know the human brain does from 3 years old and makes sense of it that way. And then when a pattern changes, how disruptive that actually is for the child. And could this preference be one of the explanations as to why that is so traumatic? Because they're looking for the pattern. They're testing it all the time. It's giving them an answer. And then when the answer is different, it's just disruptive because they've gained confidence in, to some extent, from what they've seen and the result that it gives. And when it's different, that confidence gets damaged.
Yeah, and if you take that from parents of young children to leader of a nascent team, and you've got people of those different mindsets, I think for a start, we always come back to self-awareness, right? Like, you've got to understand, where do you sit on that spectrum from extreme type E to extreme type S? And if you do sit more towards one of those extremes, so say, for example, you lean towards extreme type E, so your empathy circuit is more active than your systematizing mechanism, and you're not necessarily a natural pattern spotter, and maybe you're not as, you don't need routine as much, or changes of routine aren't as stressful for you. If you've got extreme type S people in your team, and you've got, and you're running your team in a somewhat chaotic way where you don't worry about routine, regular meetings and regular cadence, etc., that's going to be really stressful for those people. And so understanding that, and particularly when you move into a chaotic time, if we do move into really turbulent times, as might be coming ahead, then it's going to be much harder for the hypersystematizers to adapt on the fly through that time.
Yeah, because the routine and the structure is part of their bedrock of confidence and energy, right? So, and it just made me think there, you know, we talk a lot about self-awareness, and a very popular phrase of recent years in leadership is the idea of curiosity and the notion of curiosity. And for me, when I see leaders working in diverse teams, and I mean diverse in every facet that diversity can possibly be considered, ultimately resulting in every human's unique and different, and they've got their own story and things behind them, that curiosity starting point enables you to find out what's going on behind the scenes. So if someone has reacted in a stressful way to a moment, taking the space and time as a leader to, without judgment, understand the story that's gone on for that, or the experience that's gone on for that individual, could be the most critical thing you do as a leader. To not judge it, not get caught in your own story, and actually help find a way to bring that person along, because you suddenly realize, if you looked at it through the lens of systemizing versus empathy circuit, that, oh, that person requires systemization to thrive. We need to look at how we put that in place and reassure them about that.
Now, what's coming to mind are a number of things here. The self-awareness one straight away is, first and foremost, how getting a leader to understand, or helping a leader understand, where they may end up being, or may end up having a preference or tendency on that scale, that spectrum, I think is going to be vital, so that they can start to appreciate how they might respond to where anybody else in their team, and indeed their peer group or their boss, might show up on that spectrum, to think about how do they therefore interact with them, and as to Graham's point, how do they ensure that they create the space that gives enough people the diversity of comfort or conditions for comfort for them to be able to operate as effectively as they can. That's kind of the first thing. So the self-awareness. The second one is, then I wonder whether, and it's not so much a question, maybe it's just I wonder whether certain types of career path or certain types of job appeal more to people in different categories on that spectrum, and whether that therefore is something that would, it's like almost like a self-selection tendency do pattern seekers look for more scientific or analytical type environments and actually naturally feel very, very uncomfortable where it's a, I'm dealing with customers, I'm dealing with large bodies of people in a, let's say, a retail environment or call centers and so on and so forth. Even though you might say those are very process-driven organizations, it's actually the people, the dynamics and the unpredictability of the people that causes them to kind of go, this is a real clash of my own preference and the context I'm in. And how do you sort of somehow use that without it necessarily being, to your earlier point, Graham, this speed to labeling people and saying you could never do this, but how do you take that into account? And I wonder whether that might exist. That'd be fascinating to sort of explore. So you can start to understand how do you get people to play to their strengths quite naturally.
Yeah. Like the thought that came up to me there as you were talking, Jamie, is of those pattern seeking people, those systemizing people that are out there, how many look for to stay within the systems that they know because it gives them the confidence? And how many have actually developed the ability to want to continue to test those, the understanding that they have? Because there are some that do and, you know, gain great energy from being able to do it. You know, Elon Musk strikes me as that kind of person. He likes the if and then experimental world, but he's looking to, you know, to test his own tests all the time to go beyond what might be possible. And it starts from a place within him because that's his nature. Whereas, you know, I know operations that support neurodiverse people where those people contribute to society by just making sure that chopsticks are placed inside the packet for shipping. And those people get great energy from that because it fuels their strength of what they like to do.
Yeah.
So I think there's both sides for me start to come up as possible.
I think that's a really important observation. Like, so if you're a hyper systematizer, by definition, you have a curiosity about how things are working and you can spot patterns that others might not spot. That doesn't, but you don't by definition have a desire to experiment and change. Which is where the invention comes from. So I think that is really, really important. I do think that ability to spot patterns, if you're more on the empathy side and you've got people in your team who are extremely adept at spotting patterns that you might not see, recognizing that and listening to them when they talk about patterns that may not be obvious to you, I think is a really important thing. I'm also reminded of the conversation we had with Ian Hallett, which was series 2, episode 4, for anyone who wants to go back and listen, about golden rules of effective leadership. And I remember Ian talking about the way that he built his teams and that he always had an empathizer on his team. And I remember thinking that was interesting at the time, but in the context of this, I find that super fascinating that he'd recognized that, and I would hypothesize that he is a more of a systematizer than an empath.
I think he said it on the podcast, didn't he? He said it's the one thing I can't do.
Yeah. And he'd recognize that enough to say one of my foundational team members is an empath who can tell me how my team are feeling and guide me on how to respond to that. Which is super smart to be that tuned in. And now actually this book gives you tools to figure that out pretty quickly.
And just to say, we haven't been promoting this. This isn't an ad. This is just literally something Derry and I both picked up and have expressed an interest in it as our natural curiosity of ways of which people look at the world.
Exactly. Right?
So
Simon Baron Cohen, when you listen to this, if you'd like to come on and chat with us, then we'd be more than happy to have you as a guest.
Yeah. I wonder what questions it sparked in him. Does he talk about the kind of questions it's left him with in terms of what this might mean for people, leaders? Does he talk about any of that himself?
So he does. He postulates something which he very clearly says it's just a hypothesis. I don't know. But on the topic of autism, there for a long time in the autistic community, there's been a bit of controversy around what is sometimes called high functioning autism, which used to be called Asperger's syndrome. And the words high functioning are very controversial. But essentially, it means people that are autistic, but are able to function effectively in life, and in some cases have capabilities that are extremely valuable or valued by society, versus some people who are autistic and nonverbal, for example. So one of the hypotheses that comes up for him is that autistic people that are nonverbal are struggling to learn language or use language, have those attributes because they are so extreme in their systematizing that they're so hyper focused on a couple of patterns that occupy all their attention that they can't then use other parts of their brain to learn language. So it's not that they're not capable of learning language, it's just that they've been absolutely fixated on other patterns. So they're off the scale systematizers to the point where it makes it harder for them to function independently.
I find it quite amusing. Sorry, Darren.
I was just saying that's the kind of hypothesis that I remember him postulating in the book.
Yeah, it's amazing. I found it. It was like I'd read a clinical paper that had been put into a book. When I picked it up and was reading through it, I'm like, there's a lot of background evidence. There's a lot of stuff here. A lot of, you know, well written, well researched, but it couldn't be a clinical paper because it wasn't objective enough.
Yeah.
And like the book in total is 230 pages long, right? The actual work and what he writes about finishes on a page 160. In fact, it finishes on a page 149 because that's where the first 10 pages of appendix start, which are the sympathizing quotient and empathize, the systemizing quotient and the empathizing quotient tests that he proposes. And then there's literally 60 pages of notes and further reading that are all a mix of scientific paper extract, bibliography style notes, as well as things he's read that he feels contribute to the story. Because it's fully referenced throughout the whole book. All of it is referenced. So yeah. It is like a scientific paper, but with a slightly more human pointed element to it.
Yeah.
Wonder whether he was actually banned from publishing it by the university. So he had to find another way.
Yeah, maybe.
It is really interesting because it feels like this is such a lovely, what I'd call superset, within which you could start to plot characteristics, segments of population to help make sense of how do people tend to see the world and see themselves and the world, that could help in a team people to appreciate what actually is beneficial from diversity. And it's the non-visible diversity we're talking about here, albeit it might show up in behaviors, but what we're talking about here is a superset of inclinations or tendencies that could have a quite dramatic influence on how people would otherwise work together.
Yeah, and for the new leaders out there, that model has been used for nearly 100 years now, or over 100 years now, to be able to make sense of what leaders see in front of them. You know, Carl Jung's work started it off, and that got then taken into the land of MBTI. And then the number of, you know, psychometrics, diagnostics, assessments, tools that are now out there to start to objectify how humans behave. This for me is another, like you say, Jamie, another way of just looking at that.
Yeah. You know, I heard the other day, and this is just before Christmas. I can't remember when we talked about it last time, but somebody who's actually a bit of an authority in the world of psychometrics said that at present, and this was just in the US, there was something close to 15,000 different psychometric tests now in use across both education, employment, general life use. 15,000 different psychometric tests. I thought, wow. I mean, a lot of them might be just simply that Harvard have got a slightly different one from Yale to MIT to Philips or BT or whatever it might be. So some of those will be kind of small variations on a theme. But that's an awful lot of these things that have sort of proliferated. And this one strikes me as, I think, to your point, Derry, being so nice and simple. Just to go, how might you see the world? Do you tend to systematize it? Do you look for patterns? And do you feel more comfortable in that space, or are you quite extreme in that space? And or are you more about those two different types of empathy, which were the affective and I've forgotten the other one now.
Cognitive. But I'm going to lean on you two fine gentlemen and your educational backgrounds, because I cannot remember the term for this. But the systemizing mechanism and the empathizing circuit, Baron Cohen argues, are not polar to each other. So it's not yes or no. It's they're both happening, and he explores the relationship between the two. And if I think back to, my knowledge of MBTI and, well, the pattern, the preferences that come out of that are not seen to be directly in conflict with another. It's more an exploration of how they complement each other. Now, there is a term to describe this, and I cannot remember what the term is right now. When you've got, it looks like it's opposite, but it's not actually opposite. We'll leave that one for the newsletter to be answered, and people can comment on whether I was making any sense in the bottom of the newsletter when they subscribe.
Yeah, this is the Can Graham Make Sense section, which we're just going to.
It's interesting you say that. I've always sort of, certainly on MBTI, when I've had my own profiles done and I've spoken to other people, the way that I've experienced people talking about that is very much like, oh, I'm E and they're I, or I'm P and they're J, and it's very binary. But I think you're right in that the mechanism, or kind of the way that it's measured, is much less binary. And similarly with this, it's a distribution curve and you get a score, and whether you're type, if you're extreme type S, it just means that your systematizing score is significantly higher than your empathizing score.
Yeah, well, when you get into Jung's work behind it and all the stuff that gets there, what they finally teased out is that it is preference. And you do all of them. It's just the degree of which you do all of them. And that's been mainly the evolution in people's understanding. But people tend to take it as I am Omni. Well, no, you've got a preference for extroversion is technically the psychologically defined term for it.
Well, actually, when I've done MBTI a few times and come out with different sets of letters, which is not an uncommon experience, because I'm reasonably balanced on three of the four. I think TF is the only one where I'm off the scale T rather than F, which would fit with my hyper-systematizing mind.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, and to be fair, that's where I geek out a lot of the time, is taking the different ones and saying, well, where does that correlation actually show up? And like you say, the highly thinking preferenced can link to highly systemizing.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're systematizing, looking for patterns in the diagnostics.
I might be a systemizer.
Jamie, to go back to your question about what does he postulate in terms of the implications for leaders? I'd forgotten, actually, he does have a section at the end of the book, or it's actually in the middle of the book, as Graham says, but the end of the main bit of the book, talking about what does this mean for how we can support people. And I think the interesting thing there that he postulates is that we shouldn't expect everybody to do the same things. And actually, essentially what he's saying is we should allow people to play to their strengths. And he starts talking about that from an educational setting perspective, but it plays through to workplace leadership as well. So if you have a young person who is an extreme systematizer and may or may not be autistic, which doesn't really matter unless they're struggling. If you have someone who's an extreme systematizer, then there is an argument for letting them focus on the thing that is grabbing their attention and becoming excellent at that thing, rather than forcing them to be an all-rounder, as we do in our education system at the moment.
Yeah.
And I think there's an argument in the team as well for saying, well, we don't need everybody to be a line manager, act as a coach to their team members. I see this in the consulting world a lot, where you get to a certain level in a consulting firm and you're expected to become a career coach, essentially, to more junior people. And there is an enormous spectrum of experiences there where the people that are naturally really good coaches and really want to invest in it do a brilliant job. And there are others who are genuinely indifferent, but they're forced to do it and their coaches have a terrible experience. Rather than saying, let's identify the ones who have a natural lean towards that. Interestingly, I was always really keen on coaching and wanted to do lots of it despite being not a type E brain, but that's something for me to think through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you like being coached or you like coaching?
I like coaching. That's why I run a training business now. I like teaching and teaching others. But maybe I'm doing that through a systematizing mechanism rather than because I'm particularly empathetic.
Is it? I wonder, just as a throw out there, is it the process of systemizing that route to success that you enjoy?
Yeah, maybe it is. Could all be. it probably is, actually. Yeah.
That's the fascinating point, like for teams, isn't it? For leaders and teams, you know, we do spend our entire life saying be great at everything or fit my model of the world as how you should be as a human. And I see it a lot in our education systems as well. And I look there and go, well, what would happen if we just were able to enhance what's present and make that great with enough compassion to allow the difficulty of learning the other side to take place?
Yeah.
You know, I look at some of the moments that my son's found frustrating in school. And I can root a difficulty engaging with the empathy circuit as the reason why he's had difficulty.
Yeah. And so you could argue, like, why is he in an environment where that's needed versus an environment where it allows him to play to his strengths and spend more time focusing on that?
Well, in my case, it's more been about having the conversations with the school to be able to recognize that that's what might be taking place.
Yeah.
The reason why you've seen what you've seen is because something deeply emotional has taken place for him that you haven't seen or none of us have seen or understood. But he's had an engagement with it. He's lent into it and it's been confusing for him. And we know that humans, when they're in a confused state, don't like it.
Yeah.
And what do children do when they don't like something? Make a lot of noises, a lot of singing, and a lot of action that says, I don't like it.
And we just seem to develop that into different ways of showing up as we get into the workforce and beyond. We just don't necessarily scream and shout, but there are different ways of displaying that. It sounds like an amazingly powerful input to start conversations in a team. Something to feed a discussion about how do we get to know each other. So if I'm a leader today and I had the opportunity with 24 questions or 20, maybe 50 questions to give a common language and sort of an awareness of self that is visible to each other in a team setting, what a fabulous way of starting to get to know each other beyond the visible in terms of how you see each other. And I think to lay the foundations to Graham's point of to provide that space for that perhaps maybe slightly uncomfortable journey of getting to know, well, how do I therefore work with you? And how do I give you the space to thrive, to your point, Derry, in something that, you know, you are going to excel in, but also recognize perhaps within the framework within which we operate, we can't just let that go on ad infinitum, just forever. It's got to have some kind of check and balance to it. Maybe that's where the empath versus the systematizer, they just need to recognize, when do I need to draw upon what your brilliance is and what your strengths are to help me kind of keep in check what otherwise would go untethered beyond what is helpful or useful. I think it's a fascinating one. I think, as Graham said, we're not necessarily advertising the book. Love to get Mr. Baron Cohen into a conversation about this to understand how the practicalities of this play out in his mind. But as far as a context for a year of uncertainty, complexity, every reader of any kind of major trade journal this year, probably not trade, management sort of journal, will be looking at leadership challenges of mindset and self-awareness. This is a fabulous input to that debate. Graham, you had...
I found the word, gentlemen.
Go.
Interrelated.
Interrelated.
So the idea of a systemizing mechanism and an empathy circuit are interrelated. They are not directly opposite. And for that answer, I used ChatGPT.
One of the interesting things, actually, is there are, you know, he talks about 30% of people being in that type B in the middle where you're balanced, which basically means you've done your systematizing quotient and your empathy quotient and your scores are broadly the same. There's limited difference between the scores. What he doesn't articulate at all is within that type B, how many people are just low on both and how many people are high on both.
Yeah.
And I think that would be really fascinating because there must be a tiny subset of people who score extremely high on both. And those are going to be very, very capable people generally.
I would say as well to anyone listening, if you are to pick up the book and you are to complete the quotient tests in the back, they are non-clinical, they are non-diagnostic. Okay, these are merely indicators. And do not answer them as if you're trying to prove you are extreme. That's usually where most assessments of the human condition fall down slightly when you try and do that.
Yeah.
My advice with anybody of using these kinds of tools, whether they be this one or one of the other 14,999 now currently available through your nearest retailer, is take it as a start of a conversation, not a badge, not a label, not a fixed view of who you therefore have to try and behave like, but as an input to discussion. And I think for leaders, and my biggest takeaway for them is when it's useful, and in this case, it sounds like it could be incredibly useful to set the framework for a conversation about inclusive diversity of thinking that's non-visible. Here's a fabulous way of starting that conversation.
Yeah. And what I would do is I'd run a kind of anecdote type circle to tell some stories about experiences.
Yeah.
On the back of that, get your team to fill this in, make it safe for them, accept that there's huge value from anybody on any part of that spectrum, and get them to tell some stories about their experiences of what it's like having a type S or a type B or a type B.
Yeah. How's it show up? How's it like, you know, you get a team to know each other. How do you show up under stress? Because we usually defer to our extreme natural selves in stress. Brilliant.
Okay. Chaps, I think we're coming to the end of our first bit of time together this year. I know we've got some exciting and interesting people joining us later in the season, which we'll talk about a little bit more next time. Certainly invite any of the listeners to contribute their thoughts, ideas, and questions, or even suggestions who they'd like us to talk to this season. We want to make this a bit more interactive this year, see if we can start to engage with some of the folks who've been building in our audience over the last few months. And on that note, I think I'll just say it's a real pleasure to start the conversations again, chaps. I've missed this over Christmas. I now realize I've got a much bigger reading list to get through, even though only half of the book I need to read, because the rest is all index, which is all very good. So good to see you, chaps.
Good to see you too.
Thanks all. And don't forget to read the newsletter.
Find any of the subjects we cover in this podcast spark inspiration, curiosity, or concern within you, do drop us a line. Details are in the comments below, and we'll be happily there to listen and see how we can offer the best support for you.